We're offering you something a little bit different today, an episode from our friends at The Film That Blew My Mind. This one, Josh, features a favorite of ours, cinematographer, director, Kirsten Johnson, talking about, no big deal, just one of my favorite films of all time. It is, I think, still sitting as one of my four favorites over on Letterboxd, Bob Fosse's All That Jazz.
These are the kind of filmmaker interviews I really love, Adam, is hearing them talk about favorite movies that they have. And would I have guessed this? No, that the director of camera person, Dick Johnson, is dead. These brilliant, inventive, creative documentaries, that she loves All That Jazz? No, wouldn't have guessed that. And so I was so eager to find out what she loved about it. And it was a great conversation. If you want to hear more freewheeling explorations of films you know, and maybe films you don't, that could blow your mind, make sure to search for The Film That Blew My Mind wherever you listen to Film Spotting and tune in. They've covered everything from Molly Shannon on The Wizard of Oz to John Hamm on Cinema Paradiso. Each episode of The Film That Blew My Mind explores a movie that has shaped one of the most dynamic artists working today. Enjoy the episode and subscribe to the show.
A sought-after cinematographer, working with documentary directors like Laura Poitras and Michael Moore, the curious and compassionate camera work of today's guest can be seen in films like The Oath, Fahrenheit 9/11, and Citizen Four.
As a nonfiction director, she's known for approaching the subject of her work with inspirational ingenuity.
Her 2016 directorial feature, Camera Person, is a memoir and narrative collage of the world as seen through her eyes and filmed with her camera, but left out of other people's films.
And her 2020 film, Dick Johnson is Dead, part tragicomedy, part love letter to her ailing father, and part portrait of her own grief, was recognized with a Sundance Special Jury Prize, the Critics' Choice Award, and a Primetime Emmy.
She is one of the few women who have been invited into the American Society of Cinematographers, and more importantly to us, she is part of the Film That Blew My Mind family.
Today, we are delighted to welcome the fabulous Kirsten Johnson, a.k.a. KJ, a.k.a. my wife, to share the film that blew her mind.
Yay.
Kirsten Johnson, welcome to our show. It's time for the drum roll moment. What, Kirsten Johnson, is the film that blew your mind?
Wait, I have to tell the listening audience like how big I'm smiling for that introduction and the fact that I am your wife. And it's showtime. The film that blew my mind was, and it still is, All That Jazz.
Wow. Oh,
I know.
Jazz hands in the studio.
I was so excited when I heard this because it is actually one of my film that blew my, you know, after doing this, I have like five or six, but it is one of mine as well. So I'm very excited to get into it.
And Cooper, you have a little bit of the dance inside, you know?
I do. We'll probably get to that. Hopefully not too much because it'll get really boring and tedious and sad. But anyway, let's just, so if no one's heard or seen this film, let's do a little of a recap of what the film is just to set the tone. So this is director choreographer Bob Fosse tells his own life story as he details the sordid career of Joe Gideon, a womanizing, chain smoking, pill popping director choreographer. And he's putting, he's in rehearsal for a Broadway show, is starring his ex-wife in the lead. So that's all part of the plot. And, it's basically he's directing a movie at the same time, but also in a kind of an alternate universe, he's flirting with death, literally, he's in this alter world with an oddly named Angelique and Angel. You get it. It's there's not metaphor here, really. It's just straight out telling us what's going on here, played by Jessica Lange. And so then he gets to recap parts of his life as he's going down this kind of a pathway to his own death, actually. His overworked body, his workaholic life has caught up with him. So that's the main plot of all of this.
It's an incredible film. KJ, why this one? Why did you choose it?
Ooh. So many things I love about this movie and so many things that just boggle my mind about this movie. But I think why me and why this movie connect to like who I was and who I hope to be. So like the sort of overwhelming feeling I had when I first watched it was one of like, people can do this? How do people do this? So there's like an incredible sense of...
In the making of the film or...
Every level, like people can be people like this, people can dance like this, people can have sex like this. It's like the everythingness of it was so thrilling to me on so many levels. And so part of it is like, just to like rewind, I definitely did not see it when it came out in 1979, even though I was like 15 years old in 1979. I think it like just, you know, there are things I was in this very... kind of closed religious world and wasn't allowed to see movies, but there were things that were coming in from the 1970s. So like I knew Patty Hearst had been kidnapped and was calling her parents capitalist pigs with a machine gun on television. And I knew Black Panthers existed and I knew there was Billie Jean King. And I think I vaguely knew that this movie called All That Jazz won a lot of Oscars. But I did not see it and was not allowed to see it. And it felt as far away as like the revolution. So sort of, you know, Broadway show people was a world that was a sinful world from where I was coming from. And I've worked really hard to remember when I saw it for the first time. I think I saw it for the first time in Paris, and it made me really uncomfortable on so many levels. I think in some strong way, because like I really identified with Bob Fosse, Bob Fosse, the character in the movie, and Bob Fosse, the director. And I aspired to identify with him.
Wait, can I just ask you, as a young Seventh-day Adventist young woman in Paris, how did you come to identify with Bob Fosse?
There is a jump. There is a jump there. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the sort of genius of this film. I think in some ways, like it's in so deep inside a human psyche that almost anyone can identify with Bob Fosse, even though it's impossible to be him. And many of us don't want to be him in any kind of way. But, you know, the journey was long between the person I was and the person I was becoming. But I would say one thing that's sort of interesting is that almost all of the films that I saw and all of the novels that I read were written by men. All of the paintings that I love were made by men. And so there was like a strange way in which it was very easy for me to identify as a person who wished to be an artist with the idea of like, somehow I can do this, even though the only people I saw doing it were men. So there was like that weird way in which you position yourself all over the place in a movie like this. You relate to many different people in the movie. But I think I always had this sort of almost hubris inside of me of like, yeah, I can do that. I want to do that. And then, of course, like, how could I dare do that? How would I ever be able to do that?
Well, we should have a look at that opening scene and remind us, and let's get into the mood with that. There's a caveat, which is there is a lot of music and very little dialogue. But it'll give us a groove. Great, let's play the clip.
But when you're walking down that street, miles right off and you're nowhere.
There are no opening credits to this film. There's a beautiful big Broadway brassy music and all that jazz written in big Broadway lights. And then you come into this massive cattle call scene. So for those who don't know what a cattle call is, Cooper, can you remember?
Yeah, it's where they pile everybody in there to learn the routine, because then they're going to break you out into small groups and you have one chance at doing it in front of the director. And in this, it doesn't always happen this way, but in this film, he goes down and kind of filters people out as he goes. And sometimes he goes up to them personally and like gives them a word of assurance, like, you know, not for you today, baby, kind of thing. And then he just narrows it down and narrows it down. So all these people's dreams are getting sliced off as you go.
And under that entire scene, which is pretty much wordless, is George Benson's On Broadway. So KJ, yeah. Why do you love this scene? Because I know you do.
I love so many things about this scene. What I love about the scene is, you know, this reveal of all of these people attempting to dance, and the camera just like that wide shot of everybody moving together, but not dancing well yet because the space is so crowded. It's like, for me, what it feels like is just like the desire of humans to make things, and just, it's just desire. And it comes in so many different forms. And so for me, like this scene is, I think it goes on for like 6 minutes or something without any dialogue. And it's purely observational. And you're really seeing real dancers warming up, trying to do moves. You see clumsy people. You see people who are incredibly graceful. And then you see this, you know, set of people watching and engaging with these people who are trying to do something. And I love watching everybody, which is a little bit like what I love doing when I film and do camera work. And what's so amazing about this camera work, and I think in general throughout the movie and in Bob Fosse's work, is that he sort of, you know, comes from this language of choreography, goes into musical theater, then finds cinema, and then brings cinematic language back to choreography, and does this sort of back and forth between choreography and cinematography, so that by the end of the sequence, there's just these exuberant moments where the camera is underneath people jumping over it. There are people jumping in front of him crossing. But you are completely invested in this feeling of sweat and effort and people trying to do something. But the big thing that I would say in the weird way that this connects to me is that one of my great fears as a young person attempting to imagine myself a filmmaker, I was really afraid that if I made work, that it would hurt other people. This scene where he's picking and choosing people, and he's like, you know, saying yes to someone and no to someone else. For me, it created a whole like feeling of deep anxiety of like, oh, but I love all those people. How could you ever say no to any of those people? So there's a real tension in the scene for me between this great sort of love of humanity and then this very strong aspirational, like, that's stronger than that. That person's a better dancer than that person. You have to go. You really want this. And so he's not nice in all these ways. Like that I wanted to be nice as a person, but I wanted to be a strong creator. And I couldn't sort of figure out how one could do that.
Huh. It's Cooper, like you were saying, the scene as an opening to the film is also extraordinary, because like you just said, we got to meet all the characters. It's a beautiful way of setting something up with no words. And then he gave an interview, Bob Fosse, where he said he wanted to make a small documentary which would in some way capture what a cattle call was really like. And it did feel, though, those documentary elements, and one of the other reasons I wanted to have KJ on the show is to hear from nonfiction directors as well. Those little glances, the people preparing feel absolutely real and authentic. I think they were. All these dancers were getting ready for a cattle call. And there was a truth to that scene, which was fascinating, as well as, Cooper, I saw you pull your hands back as he did that huge reveal of the stage, starting in close and pulling back to that huge wide reveal. It's incredibly cinematic in fiction and nonfiction terms.
Because you have no idea where we are. When that's starting, it's just like, where are we? What is this about? And then you see it and he reveals it. It's like a great reveal. You know,
yeah,
all those bodies moving, and I do love all the scenes where they're kind of warming up, and you see everyone's little tics and worries, and the look on people's faces of like, you know, I hope I get it. Scene. It's funny too. This came. Broadway dancers had been revealed a lot in A Chorus Line, the musical, before this, so there was a story of chorus dancers. And in that Broadway show, it does really well. The movie of Chorus Line comes out a few years later after this, but sort of Bob Fosse stole the authenticity. So when Chorus Line, the movie came out, it didn't look authentic in some ways. It looked like a Hollywood version of this, where this looked very true to Broadway at the time, I think.
Well, and I think that's the other thing that I deeply love about it is its authenticity and the like the stakes are real. Like the very opening thing is, you know, a man on a high wire and it's like, you know, life is on the wire. And that
the rest of it is just waiting.
Yeah. And that's actually a quote from, you know, Carl Willenda, who was a tightrope walker who fell.
The Flying Willendas, right.
He fell and died the year before this was made. So it's a real allusion to like, this is life and death stakes. And one of the other documentary parts of the movie is that Fosse casts all of these real people in his life so that the woman who is his assistant as a choreographer on stage is Catherine Dobie, who was really his assistant. The editor is really Alan Heim, the editor. Anne Rankin, the girl who plays the girlfriend, was really Fosse's girlfriend. So there's this sense that people aren't just playing themselves, they are being.
Right, and but they're recreating themselves in a time too. It's like, I just think Anne Rankin, how hard is that? Because I think she'd actually broken up with him by then, but right. Now she has to go back in and play herself at an earlier age, and probably she thinks she was more naive then or whatever. but she still shows herself as being really needy in it too, you know?
And she's being directed by him. I mean, she's playing opposite Roy Scheider, who's playing Joseph Gideon. But she's being directed by Bob Fosse. It just kind of boggles my mind, this interweaving of life and art and construction and artifice to get to a truth. It's that someone said about authenticity. It's the most important thing. And if you can fake that, you can fake anything.
Well, and I mean, this is based on, you know, Fosse made Lenny, was editing Lenny, right, the movie, and did have a heart attack in real life.
Right.
And he made this film like fully from his own experience. And yet, hilariously, his editor says that he was in denial that it was actually him. He's like, which is so fantastic. But one of the things that I really love about this movie also is its relationship to time. So, you know, his editor called it Fosse time, but it is about being in the, like, now, being in the present, but the present that includes all of your life and all of the people in it. And so there's a way in which every shot is just, it's alive in the present in this way that, you know, obviously in Chorus Line, that didn't happen, right?
It's that is such a good point about time, because all the way through this movie, I was asking that question, apart from like, wow, how did he get away with doing this? When is now? When is now? And the way you just put it is really powerful. Now is all the things you've done, the thing that you're heading towards, and whatever's in your mind about how you're thinking about your life. It's like, It's such a crazy. I mean, this film is entirely non-linear and so experimental with what he does with time that it's kind of incredible it got made in a way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think he was a force at that moment in history. Yeah. You know, he'd won Tonys, he'd won Emmys, he'd won Oscars, and he was
all in the same year, right?
Yeah, and he was a great choreographer. So that I think, and it was also the 70s where all kinds of things were possible. And, you know, like to go back to sort of Fosse time, I feel like it's consciousness. Like we're in consciousness, we're in human consciousness. And as certainly in some ways, like as I experience it, and we're also in bodies. And so I think that's the other thing that I really love about it is how body centered the whole movie is. And that you're sort of constantly changing camera angles to think about what a body is and what it's capable of doing or not capable of doing. That like you almost feel like it's stretching you or pulling you. And, you know, I think that there's this sense of like, can you do it? Can you go as far as the movie wants you to go is being asked of you as well as being asked of the dancers.
And that whole device of going to, you know, the altered reality where, you know, it's in talking to the angel and he has to be completely honest with her. So that's why we get, cause he's such a liar in real life and tells people what to get, what he wants, mostly sex most of the time. But he has to come clean on that. So you get to see that side of him. It's very raw. And without that, it would be very hard to make this movie. So the device serves this film so well.
I mean, I think he wants so many things. And he wants comfort. He wants connection. He wants humor. He wants eye contact. I mean, I love the relationship between him and the woman who's playing Gwen Verdon, his wife, you know, his ex-wife, who was this incredibly powerful force in his life, but who could also sort of see him for the manipulative person that he was. And so, you know, Leland Palmer, who plays the role, is like often just looking at him with the sort of look of like, I see you. And the movie sees her seeing him in that fantastic scene where they're doing the read through of the script and it's completely silent. And it's only you're in his mind of like the smell, you know, sort of the sound of the cigarette, the pencil breaking, and she's staring at him and people are laughing, but he doesn't hear the laughter because it's not funny to him.
And he doesn't like this show, really. That's what's kind of interesting. He's having a hard time with this show. It's not from him like his other films and plays were. This is one where he's sort of almost a gun for hire and he's can't find it, which I love that part where he's just.
Yeah. He's trapped in it and trapped into having to like, you know, let his wife be the star, that it's cheesy. Like you know, he's trying to live up to his best self, but the money pressure, the time pressure. And I think, you know, in some ways, like that's the core of cinema is like money pressure, time pressure, and then like your vision, which you don't even recognize when you see it. And all of those forces are just like, you know, pressing together so strongly.
I think one of the things that got me about this film also is the buildup of tension. So his morning routine, which is the Dexedrine, the eye drops, the teeth cleaning, it's showtime, folks.
There's always a bottle of scope and the Dexedrine.
Smoking.
That's right. Smoking. The smoking.
The shower.
It just ramps up. So there's this relentless routine and it's showtime, folks. Ramps up the pressure, and he's under pressure from so many quarters. Yes, he's making this documentary, which is based on Lenny that he was really making. He's writing this musical, which I think was Chicago rather than Cabaret that he's trying to put on at the same time. And I can feel my heart beating faster. It's like oh, it's unrelenting.
And he's looking worse and worse as time goes on, and he's coughing harder and harder.
He keeps holding his left arm, like the signal of like he's feeling these pains. His body is breaking down totally, and he's denying it all.
But it's incredible also because this is ultimately, he makes the film about himself. People have called it, it's his 8.5. It's a kind of Fellini-esque thing. And also he worked with the cinematographer who also worked with Fellini. So it's got this
Giuseppe Rotunno.
Oh, get you. yes, exactly. So he's got this, he's already earned the license to look at his own life in this spectacularly creative, immersive consciousness kind of way that you refer to, KJ. And it is ultimately about him going towards death, doing all the wrong things, trying to be the right person, but going towards death from a heart attack. Bob Fosse actually dies of a heart attack. Yeah. Falls into the, so it's a prefiguring.
Only like 8 years later after
that's this. Right. And so. He was young. He was, I think he was 60 when he died, something. And it was, as you say, it was close. So this act of cinema, which is the most incredible, expressive, maximalist, which is why I am drawn to both this film and to KJ, the maximalism in both of you, form-breaking, but it's actually also a absolute prefiguring of what will happen to him shortly. It's kind of astonishing.
Well, I think the self-awareness that's running through the film is incredibly strong. And I do think the film is nevertheless still self-serving. Mm-hmm. Like, I do think he comes off not as monstrous. He comes off as more charming than manipulative. Like, there's never a moment where he's like truly hideous. I think we stay grounded in a identification with him.
With flawed humanity.
Yeah. But I think for me, that's part of why I was so upset by it when I initially saw it. And then why I grow to love it more in the watching and rewatching of it. Because I think this sort of willingness to the extent that one can to reveal oneself, to reveal one's capacities as well as one's shames and self-loathings and behavior that like might hurt other people or does hurt other people. Like that whole range of humanity is definitely in the film. And I'm sure there are people who knew him who would say he didn't go far enough.
Right.
But there's another way in which he went further than almost any of us could imagine going, because he had these tools. He had like the tools of choreography, the tools of his relationship to cinematography and editing. The editing is insanely great in this movie.
Yeah.
And he had all of those tools that he was deploying at this level that express huge aspiration, which I think it's very hard for humans to actually express the like grandiosity of our aspiration. And I find that very touching, this like really big, big thing. And, you know, the final number, which is Bye Bye Life, it goes on for 10 minutes. It's like, I'm going. No, I'm not going. No, I'm still not going.
I'm almost dead. I'm almost dead. No, I'm back. My heart is still beating. In some ways, he made this film as an apology too, in some ways, to all those people. It's like maybe that's why they're all in it too. It's like he copped to treating people like shit all the time. I know what you mean though. He made it probably softer than, there were days probably when he was absolutely impossible, but he kept that light. I mean, maybe we should do that clip now, because the clip is where he's showing a different side of himself that is like the sweetest part of the movie for me, I think.
So Cooper, set this up a little.
This is the I don't want to give away the line, but this is where he's in rehearsal and
with his girlfriend.
And with his newest girlfriend.
Yeah, not his girlfriend.
No. Yeah. She's
with someone he picked out of the casting the cattle call line and was like, hello.
And I will even say, remember when the guy said, I need a soprano, she's tone deaf. And he goes, with those legs, What else do you need? And then another go. Then he says some line about, I think the guy in the blue eyeshadow can hit the high notes or something like that. It's just, they have all these little quips in this movie totally. That are really funny, you know, that are truthfully. But let's hear the clip of this part. It's kind of self-explanatory. They're in rehearsal and she's not getting it.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Lay back, Victoria. Lay back. Lay back. Hold it, hold it. Sorry.
No, you're right. I'm terrible. I know I'm terrible. I look at the mirror and I'm embarrassed. Maybe I should quit. I just can't, like, seem to do anything right.
Listen, I can't make you a great dancer. I don't even know if I can make you a good dancer. But if you keep trying and don't quit, I know I can make you a better dancer. And I'd like very much to do that. Stay.
Are you gonna keep yelling at me?
Probably.
5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2.
That is such a great scene because there's a few things about that scene. One, the first is, you know, I was a dancer then and it became sort of almost a joke phrase we'd say to each other, something, lay back, Victoria, became like, it's like, it became like this thing. It was like when you weren't doing something right, you know, where it's like a joke. But also you actually see in that scene where, you know, the layout that she does bending her back is half-assed. And then when she does it, finally, it looks different. And you see, you get to be part of the process. That's the only time you really see that in the film. It's the moment where this is what a choreographer does and pushes people and how they have to hit moves and to become great. It's a great scene.
Lay back, Victoria. Yeah, I mean, yeah. For me, it shows people sweating. It shows people like going beyond what they think they're capable of doing. It also, like, I mean, I've filmed people dancing a great deal throughout my career as a camera person. And I feel like dancers are among the hardest working artists that exist. Like they just, you know, are always literally stretching and leaping and sweating. And then that moment when she is able to lay back and her eyes are still like pink and messed up and she's so vulnerable. She doesn't know if she's done well enough. And she's waiting for that moment of approval from him. But then everyone sort of erupts in this like collective moment of joy because everyone is giving that much all the time. And then collectively they get to celebrate that like she did more than she was capable of. So I find that sort of, it's just like euphoric, that collectivity of dance in this case. But I think in some ways I think of cinema as that. That it's always this collectivity of people trying to communicate, trying to do hard things together. And we sort of know how hard it is. And when like somehow we broke through and did something, feels like such a celebration.
But then also it's maybe one of those moments where he has directed his own character to be the person clearly he did in real life. He was an incredible choreographer. But the way he interacts with her, so he's very, you know, it's tough love at the beginning. And then he goes up to her when she's crying and says, sorry. And then just the real talk of, Cooper, you can do the lines. What does he say? Can I make you a better dancer?
I can't make you a great dancer.
You a great dancer.
I can't even make you a good dancer, I think.
Right.
I can try.
I can make you a better dancer. And the little details. So he comes off well from that scene.
Yes.
I also love the details of him just coughing all the time. He's got a cigarette in his mouth pretty much all the way through this movie, including when he's in the shower, when he's in the shower. But just these moments are so beautifully rendered. But he comes out of that one looking
good. I don't think he necessarily I think he comes off as complicated. I think you see him. I think Roy Schneider's performance is incredibly nuanced. And I think you see him being like, oh, God damn it. I got to go and like be nice to her now. Right. I don't have time to do this. Uh-huh. You see him lie to her and say sorry because he knows he has to bring her back from the brink. I think there's, for me, there's always a really multiple layered sense of like, this isn't good behavior or bad behavior. This is like behavior that people are engaged with to try to do this hard thing
right.
that nobody really knows the parameters of. And so that even that line of like, I don't know if I can, like, I don't know if I'm even capable of getting you to be a better dancer. Like, I don't know if I can make something of this lousy show. All of that feels like what is Fosse's actual internal experience while he is making this movie, as well as making the documentary right. that's in the movie, as well as putting on the musical comedy. Like all of it, he's in a state of being out on a wire and not knowing whether it's all going to come together or not.
Right.
So even though he has this like love of precision and like knows it'll be better if she lays back a little bit more.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know how far, like if he pushes too far, he knows she's going to break.
Yeah.
So yeah. It all feels more complicated to me than that. I don't think he ever looks good in this movie, really.
No.
Well, because Roy Scheider is such an amazing
Yeah, talk
actor.
About that. When he was cast in this, I was thought, Roy Scheider as Bob Fosse, he's not a dancer. How is he ever going to be able to play this?
And no, but does. You know there's Richard Dreyfuss first.
He's so amazing. He's so amazing in it. And he looks perfect.
I mean, talk to me about that, because it really does seem like Roy is a dancer. You feel him carry his body as a dancer. Like, how did he do that?
I don't know. He's just the sinewiness of him,
yeah.
you know, is so perfect. And
but he did talk about how nervous he was having to perfect this. He had to pull off looking like a dancer and a choreographer, which
you show up on set and go, and now slip into this. And it's like a unitard. It's just like, I'm used to wearing like an army uniform or, you know, a rugged guy.
He sure
like,
knows how to wear a hat. That is for sure.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Whew. Oh, Cooper, before we move on, you said this was one of the film that blows your mind. Why?
Well, it was what, 1979?
Yeah.
That was the year I moved to New York to be a dancer. And so,
seriously?
So I was there and we saw this, you know, every dancer in town went to see this movie. You know, it was like a big deal. And we'd all, you know, I had auditioned for Bob Fosse before too. So
what? You know, come on. Tell us about that.
I was horrible. I was the weird guy all dressed in black who might messes up. No, it was a very simple audition, I remember, and you were cut really fast. It was a very simple pattern. He was just looking.
Did you make eye contact with him?
I think so, yeah. I did him and Michael Bennett. They were the two kind of rival, you know, big choreography people. And
who in this film is played by John Lithgow.
So I think that was Bob. I kept trying to figure out if that was really Michael Bennett or not. It didn't seem quite right. It seemed like a blend of characters.
Mm-hmm.
I know. I wanted to know who those producers were too, because you know those were specific, you know.
Yes.
And I used to, because I knew Cliff Gorham, I used to wait in a, I was a waiter in a restaurant that was a very showbiz restaurant.
And what was that?
It was called Orso Restaurant in Times Square. So all these people came in all the time. So Cliff Gorman came in and Roy Scheider came in a lot, you know. So I knew all the backstories of some of this stuff as well. But Fosse had such, we haven't talked, he had such a distinct form of choreography, and it was small. Every movement had to be absolutely perfect, and he had no patience with people who didn't understand what he was doing, the isolation of a – sometimes it was like a finger move in one dance, and that had all the power. Some of the stillness with one finger moving – you know, he did Sweet Charity, he did these amazing choreo, and he had a whole style all of his own. And so that was part of it too. And he had no patience for anybody that wanted to just start flowing. You had to do it exactly.
was that you?
To do his movement. No, I got him. I was never a good enough dancer for him. His dancers were.
What a time to be in New York, and what an extra bonus bit of Cooper hinterland. I love that.
Can I talk about another thing that I think is really profound in the movie? I think that the allusion to his childhood and the fact of, you know, working as a tap dancer late at night on his own in this burlesque vaudeville, you know, really sketchy world in which, you see a scene where this group of older burlesque dancers sort of surround him. And then, of course, he goes onto stage and he's tap dancing, and he realizes that he there's a stain on his pants, and everyone's laughing at him. Right. That moment of humiliation is so extreme. And I feel like it's like a key to this deep human frailty, that when people are that deeply humiliated, it often sort of remanifests in these very dysfunctional ways. And sort of the hypersexuality of like, everyone will want to have sex with me, feels like it springs out of this moment of his humiliation and victimization in a certain way. And, and I love that is also it's so specifically and tightly shown, and it's so extreme that you feel it to your core in a way that a person would hang on to and carry that moment of humiliation their entire lives. And that's also based on a moment in his life. So there's just this way in which I think he's truly mining his own unconscious and conscious experience to inform how messy and also how glorious life is, right? Like it's doing both things all the time, but he gives us places we can point to that say like, ooh, that happened to that person. And then that person, like, stuff grew out of that. So there's just all kinds of clues like that through the movie of the intensity of a human's experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you shown this movie to a lot of people? Is it a movie that you show to people? Or
I've actually shared it with a lot of students. Because I feel like it is a movie about process and about making things and the struggle to make things. And, I try to share with them in some ways, like why this was something that was so mind blowing to me, because it was just like, it seems so impossible to me to make something like this.
It's a huge concept. Huge concept.
It's life and death. Yes. It's your whole life. As I was reading about the making of this, Fosse himself does say, like, I needed to make this movie to cope with some of the pain in my life. Mm. And I do think that that's what this sort of extreme creativity does, like, you know, pushing the lean back as far as you can, you get back into the pleasure of something that looks really good or snaps or, you know, like, and, I don't know, that connects me back to the ending scene where I just adore Ben Vereen's performance. And I think he's channeling this incredible thing of like, how do we re-channel pain into something, you know, that might be ridiculous or might be over the top, but is like the razzle dazzle of show business, is in some ways like this response to extreme pain.
What about the scene? This one I kind of forgot about, and it was so kind of almost strange at the time, where he's escaped from his room. He's pulled off his thing. He's wandering the hospital. He's escaped. It's basically what's going to kill him, I think, in the end. And then there's that woman who's in pain from cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, I just said it was cancer. I don't know what it is, but she's in pain, and he goes up and he kisses her and tells her he loves her. That was like, that was a mind-blowing scene into itself.
I mean, also that to know that one is loved as one dies in the moment of death is profoundly valuable, it would seem. And that's what he recognizes. And in a sense, it feels like that's what he is manifesting in this film. And when he did actually die, he was in the arms of Gwen Verdon, his ex-partner. Right. And I mean, it's a kind of beautiful thing. And so it is all about the complexities and messiness of humanity. And at the same time, it evokes love, which is beautiful. And what, and cinema, KJ, I know you talk about cinema as, you know, it has the ability to resurrect people. In this case, it also has the ability to show them dying before they die in exactly the same way. It's kind of mind-blowing. Cooper, I'm aware that our time is nearly up.
Okay.
Talking of mortality. Okay, so lightning round. Cooper,
lightning round.
Take
Let's
it away.
Go into it. What is the most bizarre or weirdest thing that has happened to you in a cinema?
So one of the things I love is finding out that someone I know was in the same movie theater as me in the past. So it's like, it's really hard to like figure out it, like, oh yeah, sure, we saw a movie around the same time, but to actually know that you were in the same screening in the same theater, you can almost never do. But I was telling this story once about being at Cannes and watching Wild at Heart. And there's the moment where the dog picks up a hand that's been severed off of a body. Yes. And this French man just stood up and started screaming and like, you Americans are crazy. What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? And the person I was telling the story to was like, I was there too. So it was like, that was my moment.
So that the friend was there, but also just the guy standing up and screaming at him.
And I've seen that a couple of times where people like lose their mind in relation to the movie. I also saw it happen at Lincoln Center with Adam Sandler's, the Paul Thomas Anderson, Adam Sandler movie, where the sound was mixed really high and someone just had like a fit and started screaming at the screen and they had to be taken out on a stretcher.
I remember in Berlin too, the Berlin Film Festival, if it was politically wrong and they were pissed off at it, people would go up and put their hands, if they could reach up in front of the projector.
And to block the
image. Wow. Like, we're not going to look at that. We will not accept it. You know, we will not.
That is so
amazing.
Our final question for you, KJ, is what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given or would choose to give?
You know, I love Sidney Lumet's book called Making Movies. Mm-hmm. And apparently his dad gave him this piece of advice of just love your actors, even if you hate the script, love your actors. And I think I took that, like, I think it's something that I feel when I work, but I try to just love who I'm filming.
That's beautiful.
That's actually great advice because it's a mindset that you have to put yourself into of acceptance to see it and not trying to control it. It's in a way, love is lack of control. You know, you don't want, can you just do this for me and be this way for me so it looks better in my camera? No, it's like, if you love them, it's going to all be okay and they'll probably perform for you because of it. So
yeah, and that's, I think one of the reasons why camera work has been so meaningful as like a way to grow as a person is that it makes me stop talking, so that like my impulse to control other people or to interrupt other people is thwarted by doing camera work. And so it forces me to accept more in other people's behavior.
Wow.
So it's like, yeah.
Well, this takes us back to, it's called empathy. It also takes us back to all that jazz. And so while that incredible end scene plays us out, I just want to remind our wonderful audience, I want to thank KJ for coming and talking to us about All That Jazz, directed by Bob Fosse in 1979. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. It also won 4 Oscars in 1980 for score, direction, costume design, film editing. Nothing for performances, which is kind of insane strange. To me. Yeah. But it's more difficult to find than it should be. But you can find it. Criterion have it as a DVD. I'm not sure it's on the channel, but we found it. Do watch it. You'll love it. And KJ, thank you so much. And Cooper, thanks for sharing your dancerly past.
I love that you auditioned for Fosse, Cooper. That's incredible.
It's all superb. Did.
Let's go out.
We're all still auditioning for Fosse.
Also, this I began this film with a gasp. I ended this movie on a gasp where he's being zipped into a body bag as Ethel Merman sings, "There's no business like show business."
If you'd like to share the film that blew your mind, send us an email to stories@thefilmthatbluemymind.com. The Film That Blew My Mind is hosted by me, John Cooper.
And me, Tabitha Jackson. Our executive producer is Jessica Buzzard.
The show is produced by Goat Rodeo. And to find more of their work, go to goatrodeodc.com.
Executive producers at Goat Rodeo are Megan Nadolsky and Ian Enright.
Creative producers are Max Johnston, Isabel Kirby McGowan, Rebecca Seidel, and Jay Venables.
Mixing and engineering by Rebecca Seidel. Intro music from Wayne Jones.
Marketing and publicity by Stephen Raphael at Required Viewing.
Graphics by Lee Fenvis.
Special thanks to Trevor Groth, Kirsten Chalker, John Nine, and especially Christine Buzzard. Also to all our friends and family who put up with us and our crazy projects.
Aww. If you like this episode, why don't you subscribe to stay up to date on new ones? And maybe leave us a rating and a review. Oh, and if you have any left, tell your friends.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.